This is BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare educational and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host once again, Brian Moore, and thanks for joining us. In this episode, I'm joined by part of our architectural team in our BSA Tampa, Florida studio, Tim Wagner and Sandy Troffer, to talk about designing for learning and discovery. Before we get to our conversation, let me introduce our guests. Tim Wagner is a principal at BSA, a licensed architect, and a graduate of the University of Florida, where he earned both his bachelor's and master's of architecture. Tim joined BSA in 2023. Sandy Troffer is the architectural lead at our BSA Tampa studio and is AIA, EDAC, Lead AP, and Well AP certified. She earned her Bachelor of Architecture at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute. Welcome to the show, Tim and Sandy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As many of our listeners know, first question for you both as first-time guests is going to be, how did you come to find your passion in architecture and made you fall in love with design as a career? And Tim, I'll start with you.
Well, I've always known that I was going to be an architect from as far as I could remember. But when I got to the University of Florida, I started out in architecture. And what people don't realize is I have a bachelor's in fine arts, not in art. And I got my, it turned out to be a blessing because it made me more well-rounded as an architect. And that's a good thing. I went back to the University of Florida and got my master's, and the rest is history.
Sandy, how about yourself?
Yeah, I guess I didn't always know, but sometimes I feel like I found architecture through sheer luck, and the good fortune just stayed with me for the past 16 years. So yeah, I feel incredibly lucky to have found this field. It's so hard to know what you want to dive into, you know, when you're in high school. And yeah, again, I just feel like I found it out of luck, but I love architecture and I stay with it because of the impact that both it and good design in general have on people's lives. A well-designed space, you know, for me can really transform someone's day-to-day, right? How they occupy and use a space, how they experience work, their physical and mental well-being. Beyond that, I just really love learning new things. I love collaborating with others to solve problems, and there's never a shortage of that in this field.
Yeah, passion for improving spaces is right up our alley, right? Sandy, I know you're a boomerang, as they like to say, coming back to BSA in the past few months. What brought you back to the firm?
Yeah, the people here for sure, their supportive nature and their really deep expertise. Like I had mentioned, I love to learn and there are so many resources here to support my journey. I love that I get to spend more time in our deep focus market sectors, especially in learning and discovery. Having spent some time, you know, with other groups outside of BSA, I realized how much I miss being able to focus more, develop my expertise in more specific areas, collaborate with our in-house knowledgeable powerhouses. And really grow and contribute meaningfully to really excellent and thoughtful design.
Well, we're super excited, as you know, to have you back. And I wanted to have you both on to talk about designing for learning and discovery. And I think there's several areas that we can dive into to glean some insight from the two of you. Tim, how has the concept of the university environment evolved in recent years?
Well, it used to be that you would go to a university to receive an education. And that's pretty much what their job is to educate, and that was it. But nowadays, universities have to do everything. You eat there, you sleep there, you recreate there, you research there, you learn there, you do everything on the campus. You know, there was a history of potentially some food service that was mediocre at best. Now they have food courts and student unions, et cetera. And so just to look at the food aspect is one way to keep students entertained on campus. And I believe the focus on research and on recreation and those facilities, they're not necessarily the traditional learning environments, but they're really very important today. So, you know, that's what we're focused on is research and learning environments.
So can you talk about what considerations come into play when you're designing for Florida's colleges and universities specifically? Because I know you guys are both based in Florida.
Florida's not unlike the rest of the country in that you have to follow the money, right? And the universities also follow the money. And the money is in research grants right now. So they're doing everything very well, but they're got a real focus on building research facilities to get the best of the best researchers and the best of the best students and the best of the best architects. And that's where we come in, as you know, that's something that we're focused on, and we're going to do it well and do it really well for the client.
Just to follow up on that, why do you think it's this shift towards research?
I just think that there's a tremendous amount of funding available in the research spaces, and all the universities these days want to be a top research institution.
I do hear that a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that means that they're getting more money. So the more money, the better of, the clients, meaning their students and their grad students and their postdocs and their researchers, et cetera. And it's a ticket to advance the university and the university's, their reputation across the board.
So let's shift gears a little bit. And this question's for both of you, so either one of you can jump in. What unique challenges does Florida's climate pose for architecture design?
I think Florida's climate really drives a need for building resiliency. We need to design for intense, sometimes catastrophic, unfortunately, weather events like hurricanes, which can bring storm surge, heavy rains, flooding, high winds. Flooding events are becoming more common, certainly, in other areas. Similar to other areas, we experience events like rain bombs, where we get a high amount of rain in a very short time period. So with all of this, these events and considering ground saturation and coastal areas and sea levels in those coastal areas, sometimes water just has nowhere to go. So we need to consider that when we design. We're designing roof drainage, right? Is it sufficient to carry these high intense loads, even if it's meeting building code, right? Current code, is it really up to what is needed for the current events we're experiencing? Similar to roof structure, right? We really need to consider that. Other impacts from these storms could be the building envelope, keeping water out, but also designing for windborne debris regions, along coastlines.
Let me add on there, Brian. Sustainability, which is huge for the company at large, but it's even more important in an environment like Florida, because it starts with the site selection, the building orientation, all of those things that if you don't make the correct design decision on day one, it could be catastrophic in the end when these events happen. So sustainability is not just a buzzword around here. It's the way that we do things.
And is a lot of that, some of that, I should say, like material selection as well. I mean, obviously, I'm as I like to joke with the listeners, I am not the expert. That's why I have you guys on, right? But off the top of my mind, I'm thinking of, you are facing a lot of potential wind, rain, heat, and these things, where they might be in another climate, how is that going to affect it over a 5 to 10 year period? So I'm assuming material selection has a lot to do with that as well.
Yeah, it does. I think it also has to do with the needs of your client. Are they looking for a 50-year building plus, 50 years? You're going to put more money up front in material selection. If it's a developer-run project and they just want to get in and get out, so to speak, mm-hmm. they're going to spend less money on the material selection. But it doesn't negate the fact that we still have to put a safe building in place for the general public and for their neighbors.
Right.
Because, at site selection and building orientation and all those things are really very important.
And another critical factor when it comes to material selection is the fact in Florida, for building envelope materials, we're required to meet Florida product approval, right? So it's not like you have just any old product out there. They have to go through a pretty thorough vetting process for application on our buildings here.
I do want to jump back. Tim, you were kind of talking about the research side, how a lot of universities are trying to seek that reputation. It's where a lot of the funding is. So how do you balance cutting edge research needs with adaptable learning environments? And this is for both of you as well.
Well, I could talk to the adaptable learning environment, especially when it relates to research facilities, because they're both the formal learning spaces or research spaces and the spaces in between, all the informal spaces. And both inside and outside of the building, they have to support the mission of the university, of the building, et cetera, so that there's places that they can study, they can just hang out and be themselves, be with their peers. That's important. It extends the learning environment to those informal spaces. So that's really important to consider when we're designing all these facilities.
I guess to touch on kind of the cutting edge research needs, you know, technology and resources constantly evolving. So what's considered cutting edge is always changing, right? It's never stationary. So the need to have those adaptable environments is high. So they kind of go hand in hand, right? You need to have an adaptable space to support staying current with cutting edge research. I think a lot of it, like Tim had noted, it comes down to creating flexible spaces that are easier to change as users need change and as the technology they use changes. I think a big consideration, though, when trying to find balance comes down to budget, right? Being good stewards of available resources, helping to plan for the use is part of what we do every day. Kind of similar to what Tim noted earlier, it's not an easy task, but certainly is part of the process.
No, it's not an easy task because I think of just in our everyday lives, right? Like the amount of change in what's, Sandy, you touched on, what's been deemed cutting edge. You know, what was, I'll admit, I'm in my mid-40s. What was cutting edge in the late 80s, early 90s were, you know, CDs and DVD players. And looking back on that, it's not even conceivable of what kind of technology we hold in our hands every single day and what's termed cutting edge in a lot of different fields, but especially technology. So it's tough to prepare for that for sure. Tim, I'm curious, what are some of the trends that you're noticing in higher education design in Florida?
Just playing on, you know, from this point to the last point, the inclusion of flexibility, because things are going to change. But the reason that you build a facility or a building, the core reason is not going to change. So if it's a research facility, it's going to have very specific type spaces. Those are going to potentially always be research type spaces. The type of research may change and what they do in there will change, but the actual building itself probably won't. And that's important to realize that we have as designers, we have a greater responsibility to anticipate the change. Not that we know, we don't have a crystal ball, but right. We have to anticipate that things will change because they always do.
That's a good point. Sandy, what about, is it similar in the research design space?
I definitely think there's some overlap there, especially again, when it comes to flexibility, certainly, but also allowing for multifunctional and multidisciplinary interactions and collaboration. I think that's growing, certainly. Many research projects can include inputs from many specialties, right? They can all have different needs, different infrastructure needs, different equipment needs, workflows. You have to kind of anticipate, you know, what's needed there for that collaboration. I think definitely within research spaces, safety and compliance will be ongoing, you know, thing to flag as that evolves. And a more user-centered approach, right? Accommodating of occupant needs. This could include access to natural light, you know, research permitting if that's, you know, allowed in there. The type of research that's being done could be better air quality or welcoming features, better ergonomic provisions, occupant comfort and safety, definitely. I think the last thing I would flag is energy efficient design, right? Analysis of impacts on community and environment. Research spaces can be really energy demanding. And resource demanding, and we need to continue to be innovative in how we address these facilities.
So as a follow-up to that then, Sandy, how do you future-proof designs for rapidly evolving research technologies? I mean, you've got all these considerations, and how do you, you know, I think maybe future-proof is not the best term, but how do you prepare as best as you can? Let's call it that.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, to me, future proofing is future planning, and you need to have data, and you need to design to that data, right? That's kind of how we do planning in general. But that's to me how it relates and how it carries over. Going back to me raving about getting access to kind of our in-house experts, our research and metrics team support that effort definitely. As a whole, we adopt an evidence-based design approach in an effort to support positive outcomes like better operations, lower cost, greater efficiency. As architects, engineers, and designers, it's part of our job to really get all the right data in from those that we work with, our clients, our end users. Also, as new research tech and tools are really hard to predict and plan for, like we were noticing earlier, right, with CDs no longer being in, for better or worse.
Right.
There are things that are sort of evergreen in this field. And Tim had touched this earlier as well. A good understanding of the basics are needed for that, right? Application of flexible design principles, but also understanding things like appropriate floor-to-floor heights for research and lab-type spaces. Building system selection, right? You don't want to have trampoline floors if your equipment is likely to be vibration sensitive. Infrastructure selection and location, you know, just setting those up right and for success can all help as part of future-proofing a design.
And like you said, that perfect plug for our evidence-based design and our research team there for sure. Tim, I'll come back to you. Let's talk about how you integrate advanced technologies into learning spaces.
So advanced technologies have to be at the forefront of design because you to achieve their full potential, you need to integrate them early and often. Now, as we discussed before, there things will change. You have to anticipate change and you have to build that into the process. But, you know, to integrate advanced technologies from day one is really important. And what does that mean? It can mean everything from, as Sandy mentioned, sustainability of research environments to just, you know, learning occurs everywhere. And you have to understand that those things happen at different scales and different magnitudes, but they always happen. So you have to integrate those early and often.
Thank you for sharing those things, both of you, because if you haven't been able to tell, I'm very futuristic and I get into the tech and the AI, and I like hearing where we're going from a project perspective and our thought philosophies on some of that. Tim, given all that, how do you balance the need for open collaborative spaces with requirements for focused and individualized work? There's some overlap there, right? You're trying to give people flexible spaces, but also there's this need for some focused individualized work.
It's both the formal and informal learning environments, right? The inside and the outside, they all happen at different scales. So it could be you studying solo, and you have to accommodate the solo learner. You also have to accommodate the people that are better with a group of people, a group of study mates, so to speak. And it could be 3, 4, 5, 6 people in a room together, and they're all studying the same thing. So we have to accommodate for all types and all scales of learning that have to happen in any particular facility that we would design.
I'm going to stay with this flexibility. And part of the reason is I'm fascinated by my oldest son just graduated from Butler University back in the spring, and he played baseball there. And when he was there, he would often joke like he was in probably the same building most of the day. He had classes in one area, and then he would go and weightlift in another, and they'd have a training and recovery room. And I'm just fascinated by this standpoint from how you incorporate flexibility into designs to accommodate changing needs. So I'm gonna focus specifically on research priorities. Tim, why don't you start with a learning perspective, and then Sandy, maybe you could cover, you know, some of the discovery side.
Well, I think, especially thinking about Florida, it happens at different times of the year inside and outside, because sometimes it's too hot outside to go outside, so you have to accommodate them inside, and sometimes it's really nice outside and you have to accommodate them outside.
Right. Right.
So it's kind of the building has to do everything, especially in Florida, because we do have a good climate during most of the school year, which is usually from, let's say, August through March
or April.
So we have pretty good weather that time of year. So you have to accommodate both places, so to speak.
Interesting.
It doesn't matter on the type of facility, whether it's research or learning or what, but you have to accommodate.
Sandy, any thoughts to add to that?
Yeah, as far as flexibility in a bubble, when it comes to research spaces, say a focus on appropriate location of core elements and infrastructure is a critical part of allowing for flexibility, you know, current and future flexibility, right, and adaptability. Right. Technology and resources are constantly evolving, like we were discussing earlier, and having spaces that can adapt, right, that, you know, for that future need is really important for flexibility. But really, we need to listen to our clients and end users to understand what flexibility means to them. The reality is that you're not designing for all possible solutions. You're designing for the ones that are likely to be needed by your client and end users on a more specific project based on inputs, data, and evidence available.
Well, this has been a really great introduction conversation. I wanted to have you two on, bring in some of the architecture side from our Tampa studio and our Florida team. And I can't wait to kind of dive in a little bit deeper maybe on some of these things in the future. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Brian. This was great.
Thanks again to Tim and Sandy for joining me on this episode of BSA by Design. You can connect with them on LinkedIn. If you're interested in learning more about BSA Life Structures, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. And be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. We've got more content and project stories to share on social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.